Chapter 10 Stone Age Hunters in an Icy World. In 1852, a road worker accidentally stumbled across a cave in the foothills of the Pyrenees Mountains, near the small village of Aurignac in southern France. The laborer dug into the soft cave earth, looking for buried treasure. Instead of gold, he uncovered the remains of 17 people buried with shell beads and mammoth teeth. The local priest promptly reburied them in the village cemetery. The news finally reached Édouard Larté, 1801-71, a country lawyer with a passion for geology, fossils, and ancient stone tools. Some 8 years after the original find, he rode over to Aurignac and poked about in what remained of the cave filling. His hasty dig exposed a hearth of ashes and charcoal, as well as nicely made stone tools that were clearly very ancient. Larté puzzled over his finds. Who were these ancient toolmakers? The Aurignac tools were completely different from the stone axes found by Boucher de Perthes along the River Somme. See Chapter 7. Larté's geological training kicked in, and he realized that the best chance of finding the answers lay in humanly occupied caves and rock shelters, rocky overhangs and cliffs. If many generations of people had visited the same location, the chances were that there would be layers of human occupation extending over long periods of time. He turned away from geological fossils and became an archaeologist. In the process, he pioneered a new approach to excavation that involved not burial mounds like those in Scandinavia, but caves and rock shelters. Larté excavated several other caves and found both animal bones and stone tools. His contacts among geologists led him to the tiny and, at the time, remote village of Les Aisies in southwestern France's Dordogne region. This is a wonderful part of France to explore. The Vézère and other rivers flow through deep valleys carved out by ancient floods. I always love visiting this well-watered countryside with its green fields, thick woods, and riverside meadows. High limestone cliffs tower above you. These are riddled with deep caves and rocky overhangs and sheltered gorges that would have provided welcome protection during sub-zero winters. Larté had no funds himself, but he joined forces with Henry Christie, 1810-65, a wealthy English banker who was involved in numerous businesses, including one that experimented with woven silk instead of the traditional beaver fur for top hats. Christie was also an enthusiastic collector of antiquities and became interested in Native American societies. In 1853, he visited Scandinavia, where the museum collections in Copenhagen and Stockholm fascinated him. While in America in 1856, he met Edward Tyler, an anthropologist, a person who studies living, non-Western societies, and traveled with him to Mexico. Hearing stories of Les Aisies, Christie visited the Dordogne Caves with Édouard Larté. The two men became friends and collaborators. Christie provided the funds and acquired most of the finds. Larté carried out the excavations. By the standards of today's cave excavations, this was primitive digging. Larté was a geologist used to examining layers with changing fossil animals. He knew that the earliest occupation would be at the bottom. The excavations yielded numerous antler, bone, and flint artifacts. Drawing on the distinctive stone tools and the different animals found in each layer, such as reindeer and wild horses, Larté identified several levels of human occupation. His diggings explored caves and rock shelters that are household names for today's archaeologists. La Moustier and La Faressie, as well as La Madeleine. La Madeleine rock shelter lies at the water's edge on the Vézère River. Here, Larté unearthed the finest antler and bone artifacts of all. Delicate antler points, harpoons with barbs on one or both sides, and needles. To his astonishment, he also found bone fragments decorated with fine engravings. Some bore simple patterns, while others were more intricate. Yet others had been carved into lovely animal shapes. One carving of a bison licking its flank was so detailed that the tear duct in the eye could be seen. But who had been the artists of La Madeleine? After several years of excavations, Larté and Christie had discovered a sequence of changing Stone Age societies. The earliest was the Neanderthal occupation at La Moustier Cave. The Neanderthals, with their heavy brows, were quite different from modern people. They were not like us at all. So, who were our ancestors? The answer came in 1868 when workers digging foundations for the new Lazézie railway station uncovered a buried rock shelter at a cave called Cro-Magnon. Larté dug into the back of the shelter. He excavated 5 human skeletons, including the remains of a fetus and several adults. One was a woman who may have been killed by a blow to the head. The skeletons lay among a scattering of shell beads and ivory pendants. These were no Neanderthals with heavy brow ridges. They had round heads and upright foreheads. Their appearance was identical to that of modern people. Larté believed correctly that he had found the remote ancestors of modern Europeans. The skeletons came from the same lair as the bones of reindeer and other cold-loving animals. This was proof that modern humans lived in Europe at a time of intense cold during the last ice age, now known to have been about 18,000 years ago. Larté and Christie wrote of an age of reindeer, but was this a reality? The Swiss geologist Louis Agassiz had spent many years studying the movement of glaciers high in the Alps. In periods of intense cold, ice advanced far down mountain valleys. During warmer periods, the glaciers shrank, just as they are doing during today's global warming. Agassiz wrote of a great ice age, which ended with rapid warming before written records began. The last cold period of the ice age coincided with Larté and Christie's Age of Reindeer. What were these late ice age people like? Before Darwin's Origin of Species, people had turned to the classics and the Bible for explanations of the past. Now, there was a new source of information: anthropology. The immediate and obvious living equivalents to the Cro-Magnons were the Eskimos, who had adapted brilliantly to extreme cold and found solutions to living in sub-zero conditions. There were indeed many parallels. For example, Eskimo hunters preyed on migrating caribou herds in spring and autumn. The Cro-Magnons harvested reindeer during the same seasons. Also, the ivory and bone needles that were found showed that the inhabitants of the Dordogne rock shelters probably wore tailored clothing, such as trousers and anoraks, just like living Arctic peoples. The Cro-Magnons became Eskimos in the popular and archaeological imagination. They were often depicted wearing Eskimo-like garments, including hooded parkas. Despite the huge time gap between the Cro-Magnons and living Eskimos, the comparison at least gave an impression of what life might have been like. Just as Darwin had compared fusions to very primitive ancient hunters, so Sir John Lubbock and the early anthropologists used contrasts with living non-Western societies. They gave birth to a new archaeological method. Such similarities, known to archaeologists as analogies, are a fundamental part of archaeology today. Larté and his contemporaries excavated crudely, with picks and shovels, occasionally with something smaller. Their work was somewhat like fossil hunting, but instead of fossils, they were looking for people, which required much greater care. Everyone was searching for finely decorated tools and weapons made of reindeer antler and stone tools. Layer after layer, they dug rapidly through the remains of one short visit after another, through the hearths and other traces of temporary dwellings. Contrast this approach with today's, when expert cave excavators adopt the mindset of the original visitors. They always dig with trowels, dental tools, and fine brushes, so that they can distinguish each thin layer that represents just a brief visit. Everything is passed through fine sieves, and even the smallest seeds, fish bones, and beads are recovered. A square grid laid out over the floor and electronic survey devices guarantee that every object of significance is recorded in place. The changing forms of tools provided Larté with a record of developing Neanderthal and Cro-Magnon societies. Antler and stone implements recorded technological changes through time. There were close similarities in the ways in which tools changed over time at many of his sites. Larté, being a geologist, had a somewhat impersonal approach to ancient peoples. But he was at least aware that people had made the tools and had hunted animals. Others were thinking about the French cave discoveries as well. In 1865, the British archaeologist Sir John Lubbock published Prehistoric Times, the first general account of the subject. In his book, Lubbock divided the Stone Age into the Paleolithic period, or Old Stone Age, Greek paleos, old, and lithos, stone, and the more recent Neolithic period, or New Stone Age, Greek neos, new, and lithos, stone, when Europeans became farmers. These terms are still used today. Lubbock produced a very general framework, just as Christian Jurgensen Thompson had done with the Three Ages in Scandinavia. Lubbock, with his interest in living non-Western societies, was very much a people person. Others were not, obsessed as they were with the enormous numbers of stone tools in the French caves, rather than the people who made them. Their changing artifacts became signposts of human progress, notably in the hands of Gabriel de Mortier, a French geologist turned archaeologist. Gabriel de Mortier, 1821-98, joined the National Museum of Antiquities at Saint-Germain as overseer of the Stone Age collection in 1863. He was fascinated by artifacts and brought his geological ideas to them. He had a fanatical belief in inevitable human progress that could be measured by changing tool forms, and he adapted this approach after organizing displays about the history of labor for the 1867 Universal Exhibition in Paris, a celebration of human progress through the past and present. Mortier borrowed from geology and wrote of changing type fossils, using what was a geological term to refer to tools like antler spear points and harpoons. Distinctive type fossils marked different periods of Stone Age technology. Humans and their societies had evolved in almost the same way everywhere. Mortier believed there was a universal law of human progress. This rigid-minded, geologically trained archaeologist's ideas dominated Stone Age archaeology for generations. The approach persisted because it created an impression of orderly progress through ancient times and was simple to understand. You can still see Mortier's approach in the new museum at Les Aisies. The upstairs gallery displays rows of antler, bone, and stone tools arranged in order through time. I find the beautiful displays depressing. It all seems as coolly detached as it was in Mortier's day. Fortunately, other displays talk of the Neanderthals and Cro-Magnons as people, but the tool displays highlight a problem with archaeology. Finds like knives, scrapers, and spearheads are excavated, classified, and stored in boxes. They become impersonal symbols of human behavior. You tend to forget that they were made and used by once-living people. We lose the human connection. For all this, Mortier did leave one legacy. He subdivided the different archaeological levels and their artifacts using cultural labels for each one. He named the layers after the archaeological sites where they were found. One culture with split-based antler points he named Aurignacian after the Aurignac Cave. Another, Magdalenian, after the La Madeleine rock shelter, marked by antler harpoons. This was all very geological. He forgot that stone tools were fashioned by humans, whose behavior varied constantly. Despite this limitation, Mortier's rigid approach persisted, especially in French circles, well into the 20th century. The French cave excavations may have been crude, but they launched a new era in Stone Age archaeology. They revealed Neanderthals with simple technology, followed by the reindeer-hunting Cro-Magnons with much more elaborate weapons. Larté and Christie's Paleolithic discoveries revealed vanished European societies that adjusted brilliantly to bitter cold. but they raised questions about the people who lived in Europe immediately after the Ice Age. Were they also hunters in a much warmer world, or did they become farmers? As we'll see in the next chapter, their settlements first came to light in the picturesque setting of the Alps.